I turned to the greatest Christian apologist of the 20th century, C.S. Lewis, to assess how his radically creative yet fully orthodox views on the nature of choice, sin, and heaven represent a perfect fusion of Platonic thought and Christian doctrine. This is Pints with Jack, Season 7, Episode 21, Jack's Bookshelf, Plato. After hours with Dr. Lou Marcos. Welcome everyone here on Pints with Jack. We're reading our way through the works of C.S. Lewis. This month we'll be working through Jack's Bookshelf, looking at the authors and books which shaped the life and writings of C.S. Lewis. Today we begin with Plato. Today I'm joined by Dr. Lou Marcos. He is a professor of English and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, where he holds the Robert H. Ray Chair in Humanities. He teaches courses on film, on the classics, British Romantic and Victorian poetry and prose, as well as on C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. He's been on the show discussing his books Afterlife in the Western Poetic Tradition, Myth Made Fact, and today about Plato, drawing from his 2022 book, From Plato to Christ, How Platonic Thought Shaped the Christian Faith. Dr. Marcos, welcome to Pints with Jack.
Thanks, Matt. It is great to be back on.
I'm so excited for this because I have a friend from college who is wicked smart. He has studied so much of church history, philosophy, and every time I'm with him, I understand 10 or 20%. And maybe 8 years ago, we talked about Lewis. Actually, it's probably 2017, the first year we started this podcast. And I asked him about the connection between Lewis and Plato. And he started just doing all this stuff and it went way over my head. And the beautiful part is you're such a good teacher, writer, synthesizer of information that this book was incredibly helpful to me. And so I was really excited when I saw it. We, at the beginning of the season, we see all of the different after hours. We get to select which ones we want. And I'm like, I want that one because of not only the topic, but I should also say praise for you. When I listened to your first ever conversation on Pints with Jack with David, I sent it to all of my friends too, who are not diehard listeners. And they were like, I want to just meet this individual. His energy, his passion, his intellect, his enthusiasm is just so fantastic. I was so drawn to your conversation with David. So between Plato and you, I was just really excited for this conversation. So welcome.
Hey, thanks so much. The two best things I like to hear after I give a speech on Lewis, Plato, whatever it is, number one is when they come and say, I'm going to go read some more Lewis. But the other thing I love to hear is when people come up to me and say, I understood everything you said. And it's said in such a way that they don't normally understand that. And to me, what is a professor, if not a public educator, if not someone out there and saying, just like a preacher spends his life trying to make the Bible more understandable, I see my job as a professor to make whatever it is, Shakespeare, Plato, Milton, Dante, whoever it is, more understandable so that we can all join into the great conversation. And that's what Lewis dedicated much of his life to as well. So I'm glad to be understood. There are a lot of professors who don't want to be understood, which boggles my mind. But I would like to be understood. And certainly C.S. Lewis wanted to be understood.
Well, to hit that point home too, after I read your book, I was telling my girlfriend that I'll be interviewing you. And I was explaining the key takeaways I had from it, the kind of two or three high level Plato ideas that really stuck out to me and then how they connected to Lewis. And she herself was like, whoa, that's super clear. And I never really thought about that. And now I want to dive in more. So not only did you effectively communicate to me, I was able to learn it enough from one reading of your book to pass it on to someone else, which is a double testament.
That's great.
So I felt really good. So before we dive in, you've been on the show a number of times, but what have you been up to since the last time you've been on our show?
Well, two exciting things is I've taught film off and on. I've seen at least 4,000 films, and I'm finally publishing a book on film. It should be coming out in the next few months, and it's going to be called My Life and Film, How the Movies Shaped My Soul. And I'm going to focus on the 30s and 40s, the golden age of Hollywood, Citizen Kane, Casablanca, Wuthering Heights, It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Smith Goes to Wife, Bringing Up Baby, and I go through them all. And talk about why they're great films, but how they affected me and shaped the way I view the world. But even more exciting, especially for this podcast, I just a couple days ago signed a 2-book contract with IVP Academic. IVP is the one that published From Achilles to Christ and From Plato to Christ. Mm. And I've got a two-book deal. The second book coming out will be called, get ready for it, From Aristotle to Christ. So I needed to do that. Yes. Next. Even though I'm a Platonist at heart, I needed to dig more into Aristotle. It took a long time. But the first book that's coming out, I'm very excited, is called Passing Down the Torch, How to Educate the Next Generation. And it's about education, particularly classical education, which is my passion. Now, sometimes titles change with publishers, but I'm sure From Aristotle to Christ will not change. We'll see what happens with the education book. But that is my passion, to advocate for the kind of education that people like C.S. Lewis had, a classical Christian education, and how that opened their mind to so many possibilities. So that's what's coming soon. I'll be busy.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, depending on what your schedule is like, I would love to invite you back on the show for when that one comes, because I'm going to want to read that book no matter what. And so it'll be fun to nerd out about it afterwards.
It is a date.
I love it. Well, beautiful. Well, let's dive in here and let's start with, before later on in the conversation, jumping to the connecting it all to C.S. Lewis, let's just start with Plato himself. Who was Plato at a high level? When did he leave, or when did he live? What sort of world was he born into? Just a little bit of contextual information about Plato.
Well, best place to start is the little mnemonic device everybody remembers. There was this first great philosopher named Socrates, and then he had a star pupil named Plato. And then Plato had a star pupil, and his name was Aristotle. And then Aristotle had a very famous pupil named Alexander the Great. And when Alexander the Great conquered the world, actually, he really conquered Asia more than Europe. When he conquered the Near East, he spread the Greek thought of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle through what would become the Roman world. And then that Roman world would become the Christian world. So you can't be a Christian without understanding something about these great philosophers, because they laid down a philosophical foundation that was very helpful to the early church and even the medieval and Renaissance church. Now, Socrates is a 5th century figure. The golden age of Greece is the 5th century. In 490 and then again in 480 BC, the Athenians defeated the Persians and stopped them from taking over Greece. And that propelled Athens into a golden age. That is the age of the great tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. It's the age of the historians, Herodotus and Thucydides. And it is also the age of great architecture like the Parthenon. But it's also the age of philosophy. And the great philosopher Socrates was a fully 5th century BC golden age figure. He was executed in 399 BC, sort of ending that age. His student Plato was born in the 5th century BC, but died in the 4th century BC. So he is a figure that straddles that. And then Aristotle is fully a 4th century figure. And he is sort of the tail end of the golden age. So when Plato was growing up, he was a boy in one of the great times of the early antiquity. A time when ideas were everywhere, when it wasn't just Athens, but Athens was in contact with the whole Mediterranean world. It was the birthplace of humanism, when people started asking major questions like, who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? How do I know I have value? What is the nature of goodness and truth and beauty? What is the nature of the good man, the good state, the good life? They were asking these questions, and there was a sort of energy in the air. And Plato grew up in this incredible energy. But sadly, there are two things that really established, I think, Plato's character. First, he grows up in a time of fertile thought. He was a student of Socrates. Socrates taught him the Socratic method of dialectic, where you use a series of questions and answers to get to truth. Now, unfortunately, before you can get to truth, you have to wipe away all the untruths that have gathered around things. So first, you have to wipe the slate clean, and then you can start seeking after truth. So he was part of that. He saw that no question was off the table. He was excited. He was eager. He wanted to know. But then I mentioned in 399 BC, the radical Athenian democracy put Socrates to death partly because he asked too many questions and was driving everybody crazy and forcing them to own up to the terrible behavior and justification they were doing. So what Plato saw was the glories of philosophy, but he also saw the dangers of it. He saw how sometimes the world did not want to hear about goodness, truth, and beauty, and would swat the gadfly that wanted to wake it up. And so Plato, again, understood that philosophy was a serious matter, but it also brought a kind of danger to it. And what I argue in my book, because a lot of people have different theories about how Socrates and Plato go together. Socrates did not write anything down. Everything we know about, well, there were other people named Xenophon and whatnot and Aristophanes, but the major person that teaches us about Socrates is Plato. And I would argue that the difference between Socrates and Plato, when Plato is being purely almost a recording device of Socrates, and when Plato's going off on his own, in the early Platonic dialogues, we ask questions like, what is the nature of beauty? What is courage? What is friendship? And what Socrates does is he asks a question, somebody gives an answer, and then Socrates, through questions and answer, shows him that that answer is foolish and needs to be thrown out. But what's frustrating about the early dialogues of Plato, and I consider them to be the most Socratic, is they always end in an impasse. In other words, we're never given a real definition. We have wiped the slate clean, and then everything grinds to a halt. And I believe that Socrates did the preliminary work of, again, wiping the slate clean. If I want to see truth with a big capital T, I can't do that until I wipe away all those little T's, all those not absolute truths, those relative truths. And only once I clean them away can I see clearly to the real truth. And I believe that the real Plato steps in his middle dialogues, where I, even though Socrates is still the speaker, I think Plato is pushing forward to arrive at actual definitions that will change the world of philosophy. And I think it was Whitehead that said, in some ways, all of philosophy is a footnote to Plato. It's amazing what he did. He asked almost all of the questions and then left it to everybody else.
That's incredible. Were there any, this is more just a side tangent curious question, were there any, as you describe Socrates as putting away the little truth, and as he asks a question, essentially kind of showing the absurdity of them as he goes down the path and really pushes, which first of all, you're making me think of a singular friend that I have in my life that does that. Every conversation we have, he never takes a stance, but he just always counters all of mine. And it's so frustrating, but it's also like refreshing in a sense that it challenges me constantly to like question whether I'm actually holding a belief that has really been thought through to its end. So I'll have to send him a text and thank him for his.
The motto of Socrates, and I try to make it my motto, the unexamined life is not worth living. Another one is you need to follow the argument wherever it leads. Somebody that did that was a famous atheist named Anthony Flew. And he followed it to the end and became a theist. He didn't become a Christian, maybe on his deathbed, but he followed the argument and tried to see where science was going, and he ended up a theist, a believer in God. I think Plato would have been very happy.
I love that. Sometimes I was thinking when I was reading your materials, I was almost like, especially, and we'll get to this part later, but as so much of it seems to be laying the foundation for Christianity, I fully agree with your statement. Not that you need me to agree with it, but you proved it to me as I was reading this. It almost feels like they're like the beginning steps of revelation to some degree. Like God is using them, despite all being pre-Christ, of just like laying the groundwork of thought for what is about to come in such an instrumental way. And I state that so listeners can realize just how influential this was. And would you say, is it safe to say that prior to Socrates, prior to Aristotle, a lot of this type of thinking or worldview was not really present there? Because it really does lay the foundation.
It really wasn't. Now, I spend a little bit of time in the first chapter by talking about what are called the pre-Socratic philosophers, the ones that lived before, between about 600 BC and about 450 BC. Mm-hmm. And they laid the groundwork. They were the first ones. And some of them, there were particularly one named Pythagoras and another one named Parmenides, that did have a profound influence on Plato because they did believe in the spiritual realm. But oddly, many of the early pre-Socratic philosophers were almost what we would call materialists, that they basically believed everything was matter. And they tried to figure out what the original substance of everything was. And they thought it was it must be a material thing like water or air or something or fire. And so the funny thing is that some of the people who lived before Socrates, we would almost call them evolutionists. They believe everything could come about by material. Right. So it's come full circle. And I wrote another book called Atheism on Trial, and it was the publisher that gave it that crazy name. My original name was There Is Nothing New Under the Sun, because one of the things that drives me crazy about the new atheists is they try to present this belief that their arguments, their atheist arguments, are based on new research in science or history or philosophy or psychology. No. Everything the new atheists say has been around for thousands of years, and most of it has been answered, not just by Christians like Augustine or Aquinas or Chesterton or Lewis. It's been answered by the great pre-Christian thinkers like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero. And so that's what I argue there, that this idea that in the beginning everybody was a creationist and then later they evolved into an evolutionist. No, both ideas have existed side by side for thousands of years, but they've had an ascendancy or a descendancy, depending on what was going on. So we can thank Plato for wrestling down all these pre-modern evolutionist materialists, I mean, and kind of kept them quiet. And then along came the Gospels, and then along came Augustine, and they were sort of depressed for a long time until they finally came into their own in the Enlightenment. And we'll wrestle them down again, right? But we need to understand that Plato helped lay the foundation for an understanding of the world that was supernatural, but also philosophical. Something that Chesterton said in his book, The Everlasting Man, we mentioned before, is that it's a wonderful thing when the shepherds and the wise men come together at the feet of the, even though they weren't there at the same time. But we know the image coming before the Christ child, because in the shepherds, what Chesterton sees are the common people, the sort of superstitious people that don't really have a philosophical view of the world, but have a haunted view of the world. And then you've got the magi, the wise men, who are very philosophical, very intelligent, but they tend to be more materialistic. And then suddenly they come together, because in Christianity, we have philosophy and theology coming together. And I do believe that Plato lays the foundation for it, which doesn't mean that Christianity is merely plain. Look, let me say this before we move on. Why did I write this book? One of the reasons I wrote this book is very important. When I was a kid, there were a lot of theological liberals who, whenever there was something in the Bible they didn't like, they blamed it on Paul. Well, you know, that's Paul. I only listen to the words in red, by which, of course, they mean the words of Jesus. It's kind of funny because people that say that usually do not believe in hell or devils and forget the fact that Jesus talks more about hell and devils than any character, any figure in the whole Bible. So but what I have found today over the last, say, 30 years is a lot of evangelicals, people that are supposed to be conservative theologically, whenever they see something in the Bible they don't like, well, they can't say that's St. Paul, because they're supposed to believe in the whole Bible and to be very Pauline. So I have found what they say is, well, that's just Plato. That's how they diffuse things. So anytime they see any kind of hierarchy, any kind of absolute truth, anything like that, that they don't like, let's blame it on Plato. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to explode that and to see how I believe the God of the Bible used Plato to partly get the ground ready for the building of the full theological understanding of Christianity. It says in the Bible, Jesus came in the fullness of time. Well, look, part of that fullness of time is that Jesus was born during the beginning of the Roman Empire, during the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, the longest reign of peace the Western world has ever known. It was born during a time when the gospel could spread all over the globe. Well, I would argue that part of the fullness of time is the philosophical foundation that was laid that gave the early Christians partly a language to express the truths of Christ, right? Because the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, but the New Testament is written in Greek. And God meant for that, right? I mean, Jesus would have taught in Hebrew or Aramaic, but the Bible, the Old New Testament, was written in Greek. And of course, the Old Testament had been translated into Greek, the Septuagint. That's partly the influence of Alexander the Great, right? The student of Aristotle, who was the student of Plato. God is putting the pieces in place. It's not like God spun the globe, like the joke we do when we're kids. We spin the globe and put our finger and say, that's where I'm going to live. And we end up in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, usually, right? But no, God knew what he was doing. And the world was prepared. What Greece and Rome had done, and of course Israel, prepared for the coming of Christ in the fullness of time.
I want to take a little bit of a risk with this question and deviate slightly from my rough idea where I was going to go. We're about to transition to some of his bigger themes and then obviously kind of unpack those a little bit. But I want to try, you mentioned a comment of how some denominations will say like, this is Plato and that's why they'll discount it. So I want to ask you to almost take the negative side of it for a second. What is it that they don't like about Plato? You know, just to push into that a little bit further, like we're about to talk about all the positive influences. Why do they look at it as a negative?
I think what they don't like about Plato is that in Plato, there is hierarchy, right? Unfortunately, America in general, particularly the evangelical church, has been hijacked by what I would call literally the heresy of egalitarianism. The idea that everybody should be the same, that we should collapse all distinctions. And that's even happening with men and women now. I mean, it's insane. And good evangelicals are complaining about that collapsing, but we have enabled it to happen because let me just give you an example of this. It's really funny, Matt.
I love this.
Because I'm a Lewis scholar, I get to write for all different denominations and whatnot. And there's something I only noticed about 5 years ago. Okay, I'm a pretty traditional person. So when I write essays, I say St. Paul and I say St. Augustine. And it didn't strike me until a few years ago that whenever it was, you know, Catholic, Episcopalian, something like that, they kept it. But whenever it was a good evangelical, I'm a Baptist, a good Baptist, they would all change it to Augustine of Hippo and Paul the Apostle. Now, why did they do that? They didn't like the idea of saint. Now, look, I'm a good evangelical. I know the Bible says that we are all saints, okay? But what is this childishness about not being willing to call someone a saint? We think we're doing it because we're biblical. We're really doing it because we're egalitarians. We don't like this idea. Like, oh, I'll bet you think you're holier than I am. This is nonsense, okay? Can you imagine if we ran city symphonies on egalitarian principles? Would you pay money for a season pass to go to the Houston Symphony if they just let anybody in that wanted to? Would you go? Would you buy football tickets if your city based its football roster on egalitarian? Well, actually, that's not a good example because that's basically the Houston Texans. But anyway, it's this sort of crazy thing, okay? We need to be careful. And by the way, I want to tell you what's funny, Matt. Baptists do actually have saints. You know what we call them? We call them missionaries. And we look up to, especially Wycliffe Bible translators. We hold them more esteem than any Catholic holds up a saint, okay? So what I'm getting at is we need to understand and accept, okay, that Christianity, although it gives all people equal value and worth in God's eyes, is not about collapsing everybody. We're misunderstanding. In Christ, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, this or that. We now all have equal access to the Father through Christ. But that doesn't mean we're all the same. There actually are people that are more spiritual than I am and you, and people that are more spiritual than them. I mean, we have no problem understanding that certain people are more athletic than we are, or like I said, more gifted in music. But why is it that we're so uncomfortable if anybody tries to rise themselves to a higher spiritual level? And then we're like, oh, that's works religion or something. So I think Plato is showing us that there are absolutes and that there are people that are higher up that path than we are. And that's okay. We should be inspired by them and not envy them. And ultimately what tore down Plato, what tears down democracy is envy. And if you think I'm just making that up, the 10th commandment is thou shalt not covet. And thou shalt not covet is the same thing as thou shalt not envy. And as far as I'm concerned, the first murder in human history when Cain killed Abel was because of envy. And listen to Jordan Peterson because he's brilliant on that. He gets it more than a lot of Christians get it, right? crazy. But that's the reason. I love that. Now, it is true that what we have to be careful about in Plato, and of course I write this in my book, is that the Greeks in general tended to have a lower view of the body. So that salvation meant the soul escaping the body and casting it off. Okay? But that's more the Neoplatonists, the ones at the time of Augustine. And anyway, a lot of times the very people that attack Plato for that are the people that have bought into an unbiblical American dualism that says soul is good and body is bad. So I find it very, very odd that some of the people that accuse Plato of that are actually more guilty of it themselves, who think they die and became angels and go on to heaven. In my book, I write about It's a Wonderful Life, one of the best movies ever written, but it's very bad theology, okay? Because we do not become angels when we die. And again, I try to show that Plato is not so simplistic as that. It's really more the Neoplatonists after him. And we need to examine ourselves and understand that there are absolutes and there are hierarchies, and that's a good thing. Hmm.
I love that. No, that was super helpful. That made me think of a conversation I had with Dr. Chris Armstrong on C.S. Lewis' Guide to the Medieval Church.
Oh, yeah, I did a review really of talks, book. Very good book.
Yeah, and it talked about something similar of like trying to break down the hierarchy in like mediation versus individualism and direct versus a little bit of hierarchy. And there's a fear depending on which camps you're in and stuff. It was a really good conversation. But turning our attention to some of his main themes, and I want to create space for you to bring up any ones you would like of his. But when I was going through the book and some of the ones particularly you draw a lot on in the chapter on C.S. Lewis within there, is the large world of becoming versus world of being, that divide, and the myth of the cave were some concepts that really stuck out as connecting. You know, I'd love just to hear you kind of talk about some of his key themes that he has, and then particularly maybe some that relate to Lewis itself.
Let's start with, again, it's a weird thing because, yes, in one sense, Plato talks about the soul escaping the body. Okay, in one sense, that can lead to a kind of Gnosticism that sees creation itself as the fall, because matter is inherently fallen, right? And part of the problem, I hate to say it, but part of the problem is St. Paul. Could Paul not have thought of a better word than the flesh to mean the sinful nature? I understand why people are confused. Obviously, Paul does not mean this by the flesh, because if he meant this, my skin was fallen, then the incarnation by which Jesus became man would have been impossible. So that's not what Paul means, but I do think it's confused people. I wish for a while, the NIV tried to translate flesh as sinful nature, but I think it just confused people. We just need to understand that when Paul says flesh, he means the sinful nature. He doesn't mean our skin, right? So there are too many people, and again, especially evangelicals, right? When we think of heaven, we think of heaven as the earth with all the stuff thrown out. Why is it, Lewis says this himself, why is it that we always use negative language when we talk about God or when we talk about heaven? So I am corporeal, God is non-corporeal. No, God is not non-corporeal, God is transcorporeal. He's more, right? It's not I'm personal and God is impersonal. I'm impersonal and God is transpersonal. Unfortunately, there are certain people that have ruined the meaning of the word trans, okay? So we won't go there. But trans in this sense means God is more than the physical, more than the personal. Heaven is not only more real than earth, or I really should call it the new heaven and the new earth. That's what heaven is, right? It is not just more real, it's actually more concrete. And the odd thing is Plato, the supposed Gnostic, and again, there are dangers there, is the one that shows us that the heavenly realm is in some senses more real than the earthly realm. Now, yes, our world is not just an illusion. You can push Plato too much. But you know what? In relationship to the thundering reality and concreteness of the real heaven, of the new heaven and new earth, it is like we're living in what Lewis called the Shadowlands, right? At the end of the last battle, which is the last of the Chronicles of Narnia. Spoiler alert, everybody dies, and they all go to Aslan's country, and they find that, again, it's more real than Narnia. And then the professor said, it's all in Plato. It's all in Plato. What do they teach these children? Well, what is all in Plato, right? What's in Plato is the understanding that, yes, I'm not saying our world is unreal. This is not like Hinduism where the world's Maya, okay? The point is, look, when Jesus says, you cannot follow me unless you hate your mother and your father. Obviously, we cannot take that literally because it would be breaking the commandment, thou shalt honor thy mother and thy father, right? So obviously what Jesus is saying is our love for God should be so full and rich that in comparison, it would be as if we hated our father and mother, right? So earth is not unreal, but in comparison to the thundering reality of heaven, it is like we're living in the shadowlands. Now, what Plato showed is he breaks the reality into our realm, which he calls the world of becoming, and the heavenly realm, which he calls the world of being. In the world of being, everything is perfect, right? Everything is in its perfection. But we, the dividing line is the moon. Everything above the moon is in a state of perfection, right? It's moving, but it's moving in circles, and circles is perfection. Aristotle developed this a little bit more. And unfortunately, he held back a lot of astronomy because of that. But anyway, but our world is a world of constant change. Everything changes, everything decays, everything dies. But up there in the world of being is where things are perfect and unchanging. So in our world of being, we have lots of different kinds of trees and lots of different kinds of dogs and lots of different kinds of people. But up in the world of being, in the world of perfection, we have the ideal or form of those things. We have tree with a capital T or dog with a capital D. We also have truth with a capital T, goodness with a capital G, beauty with a capital B. That is the essence of things. And what we see down here is a reflection or an imitation. Now, why is it that there are so many different varieties of chairs? There are different colors, different textures, slightly different shapes, but we recognize them all as chairs because, Plato would say, they participate in the form of the chair. Chairness, chair with a capital C. And that's not just true for objects. Again, it's true for abstract nouns like goodness, truth, beauty, justice, friendship, all of those other things. And that is where we can have an idea of there being absolutes. We don't understand that a person like Nietzsche, when we say he's an atheist, we don't only mean that he doesn't believe in God. Nietzsche and nihilism doesn't believe that there are any absolutes, right? There is no absolute truth. Absolute truth is a truth that we made up and then forgot we made it up and called it absolute truth. I think it was Michel Foucault who liked to say that truth was an ideology. The idea of absolute truth is just one other way of structuring reality. But there is no absolute truth. There are only man-made truths. And if you go as deep as Marx, even our man-made truths are products of deep social economic forces over which we have no control. So what Plato gave us, and it's true to the revelation of the Bible, is Plato would have us live in a top-down world. The original stuff is spirit. That's where the primary things is, and the secondary are down here. Marx, Darwin, Freud, Nietzsche, all of them, Sartre, all of them have a bottom-up view of the world. Reality is the material, the physical, the natural. And everything evolves out of that. So the difference between, quote, creation and evolution is not just six literal days or six figurative days. It's a statement about the nature of reality. Is the spirit primary or is matter primary? And even though the Bible is the only book that says in the beginning God, even though all mythology, including the myth of evolution, says in the beginning is stuff and matter, Plato, especially in a book he wrote called The Timaeus, comes closer to creation, ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, than any other ancient book. So again, and funny thing is, Matt, that during the Latin Middle Ages, right, in Byzantium, they still had everything because they spoke Greek. But in the Latin Middle Ages that influenced us in the West here, they lost almost all of Plato, and all they had was a part of Timaeus. And I think it's God knew what he was doing, because all the books of Plato, Timaeus tells a origin story, a creation myth, and it comes closer than anything else to talking about the not only space, but time as being something created. And to show you how influential Timaeus was right up until we get to the dawn of the Renaissance, if you look at the famous painting, The School of Athens, it's a fresco by Raphael. It's that famous thing with the steps and all the philosophers there. And in the middle are Plato and Aristotle. And Plato's pointing upward to the world of being, and Aristotle has his hand like this pointing downward to the world. And each of them is holding a book that defines them. And the book that Aristotle is holding says ethics on it, the Nicomachean Ethics, which will be a centerpiece of my Aristotle and Christ book when that comes out. But what is Plato holding? He's not holding the Republic, as you would expect. He's holding the Timaeus, the book that he was known by from Augustine all the way up to Raphael. That was the major book by which Aristotle was known in the Western Christian world.
What do you think got him to this thought? So he, like you said, we realize he was quite close to what we would say from a Christian thinking, well before the Christian thinking was developed. Was there sources that he was reading that were inspiring him? Was there a progression of thought that he had that made him believe there must be a God and it has to be this way just through independent organic thinking? Or do you think it could have genuinely been God placing a bit of revelation in his heart to try to help prepare the world for this? Like, I'm genuinely curious how someone gets it this close before we knew.
It starts with Socrates, okay, with two things. Okay. First of all, in his apology, his defense, Socrates tells a famous story about how one of his friends went to the Oracle of Delphi and asked who the wisest of men was. And it turned out that no man is wiser than Socrates. And Socrates did not believe that. So he went around trying to disprove what the oracle said. And so he started by questioning the politicians, figuring they were wise. Was he mistaken? Then he went to the poets, thinking they were wise. And then he went to the craftsmen, the artisans, thinking they were wise. And what he discovered was that they all thought they were wise. They all thought they knew what truth was, but they were ignorant. They didn't know. And Socrates finally decided, well, I don't really know myself, but I'm wiser than them because I know that I do not know. There's a sort of Socratic humility there about the limits of knowledge. And from that point on, the centerpiece of Socratic philosophy is definition. We have to get to definitions. And I think the breakthrough was the idea that it's not a real definition if it only applies to this, but not to this and this and this. So we're trying to move from definitions that are only descriptions of one thing or a bunch of things to try to get to a definition that will tell us not just what this specific kind of justice or this kind is, but what is justice in general. And I think that's what inspired Plato to seek after what is truly true and what is really real. The other thing is Plato, like his, you know, fellow Athenians, reading Homer, loving Homer, but thinking, if this is what the gods are like, then where are we going to get any standard for what is good or true or beautiful? It's a little bit of a stretch to say that Plato was a monotheist, but I think he is moving and groping and struggling towards monotheism because he seems to realize that if that's what the gods are, then we are without any standard. And the reason why he, you know, said children should not be reading Homer, it's not like he is a censor in the way we think of it, 1984 Brave New World or something like that. He's saying just what we would say. Would you allow your children to read stuff that is filled with lies? No. Well, maybe our modern schools, but I hope you won't allow it, okay? You wait till they're of age to understand and discern. So it's not like we're throwing it out completely, but he's saying, how can you raise children to be morally self-regulating if the only understanding they have of the divine is a bunch of party gods running around killing and sleeping with everybody? How are you going to have any standard of truth for that? Socrates and Plato loved Homer. They quote him all the time, and they're clearly quoting him from memory because they make mistakes. So they obviously are quoting from memory, and that's how much they love him. But Plato is understanding that, again, that there's got to be more, right? If there is any hope of something like justice with a capital J or truth with a capital T, there must be something beyond the world, beyond the gods, that is the standard of that. And to me, that is his great breakthrough, and that he's just working his way through all of what we would call abstract nouns, through all of the different things, most famously in the Republic, trying to seek what is justice with a capital J. And he's moving towards that, and I think he's coming closer towards the truth. Right? I mean, a good example of this is Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. Jethro was not a Jew, and yet Moses asked advice from him. We might say Jethro was one of the first virtuous pagans. Actually, I'm sorry, the first virtuous pagan is Melchizedek, whom Abraham meets early on. What is that? Genesis 15? I can't remember which number it is. But early on in Genesis, he meets Melchizedek, who worships El Elyon, God Most High. And Abraham recognizes that there is a truth in Melchizedek. And of course, Melchizedek becomes a type of Christ to come. So we do have examples of, as Stephen tells us in his great sermon in Acts chapter 7, I think it is, as he tells us in Acts 7, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Just, of course, as Daniel was raised in the wisdom of first the Babylonians and then the Persians, and used that wisdom. So the answer, of course, is both. I do believe that Plato, look, the Bible says we see now dimly in a mirror. I think some of the virtuous pagans, as Dante calls them, they may have seen very dimly in a dirty mirror, but they saw something, right? I don't believe they were blind. Because God speaks not only through special revelation, the Bible, the prophets, Christ himself, but he speaks through general revelation, through creation, through our conscience, through our reason, through our imagination. And I believe, and just like Dante believed, that Virgil represented the farthest human reason can go apart from direct divine grace and special revelation, I believe Plato is that too. He went as far as he could on his own steam, and then it was ready for Christ to come. So God used him to prepare the Greco-Roman world. That's part of what he means, I think, when Paul says at the Areopagus in Acts chapter 17 to the Athenians, I see that in every way you are a religious people, for you have temples to every god. You even have a temple to an unknown god. And then he speaks the word that is, you know, the very impetus for everything I do, because I'm always trying to bring Athens and Jerusalem together. He says, now, therefore, what you have worshipped in ignorance, I will proclaim to you as known. And that's what I think happened. I think Plato understood some of what he did, but I don't think he understood everything he did. I don't think John understood Revelation. If we asked him, what does it mean? He would say, I don't know. I just wrote down what I saw. Okay. Go ask Hal Lindsey. No, just joking. Anyway, I don't know. Do you remember that guy? Anyway, so yes, I think Plato was inspired the way Homer was inspired, but not directly inspired. He did not know. Of course, he didn't know Christ. That hadn't been revealed yet. But I think he went as far as he could with the general revelation that was given to him, and he stands at an apex. Again, preparatio evangelium, the preparation for the gospel in the pagan world.
That was really well said. It's super clear. One final thing before kind of connecting it a little bit to C.S. Lewis. Can you walk through the myth of the cave? I thought that was insanely helpful, what you wrote on that. I mean, it made it, I don't think I've ever seen a more clear way of describing it all. And that framework then just carried with me through the rest of everything I was reading in your book. I was like, well, that's
right.
Really
thanks. And we should know that the words allegory and myth are pretty much interchangeable the way played. So we call the allegory of the cave and the myth of the cave. And I think, so there's those early dialogues, right, that I think are almost pure Socrates. And then the middle dialogues, and that's what's Plato's note for, the Republic, the Gorgias, the Phaedrus, the Phaedo, the Timaeus, the Symposium. These are the great, great middle dialogues where I believe we have the mature Plato moving into truth. And all of those dialogues have a central myth. Usually it comes at the end, a myth that takes all of the abstract philosophy that Plato has been trying to arrive at through question and answer, and it takes them and it puts them into a myth. And the myths are often about origins, or they're about like final judgment. They're about the way things are. They're about the journey of the philosopher. And I think those are the best parts of Plato, and I spent several chapters. The Allegory of the Cave is the best known. Republic ends with something called the Myth of Ur, which is about death and judgment and all of that. And they're wonderful. Now, the crazy thing is, and we won't have time to go into this, Plato talks about reincarnation. Did he believe literally in reincarnation? Pythagoras did, and Plato was influenced by him. But the weird thing, Matt, is even though he mentions reincarnation a lot, he only mentions it in his myths. It never appears in the dialogue, the philosophical part of question and answer. It only appears in the myths. Mm-hmm. So did he believe, did he not? It's a little bit hard to say, but he certainly uses it to help understand why things are the way they are. Now, in the famous Allegory of the Cave, he is trying to explain to us what the nature of reality is. And he's already done so with a very complex thing called the line that's divided. And we could talk about that, but it's better to jump into the myth. And he said, yep, we are deceived about the nature of our world. We are like prisoners who are trapped in a cave. So imagine this deep, long cave with a long tunnel. And at the very back of the cave is this big grotto with a wall at the end. And we are like prisoners who are in chairs, and we're tied in the chair, chained, so we can only look forward. So all we can do is look forward at the back of the wall. Our whole life, we've been looking at the back of the wall. Now, behind us is a roaring fire. And between the fire and our back are these puppeteers who have puppets or cutouts. He calls them like paper cutouts. And they're walking back and forth, moving these puppets or cutouts back and forth. And these marionettes look like everything in our world. They look like horses and trees and people and everything. Now, as those cutouts go past, the light from the fire casts the images of the puppets onto the wall. And all we've seen throughout our whole life is the shadows on the cave wall, and we think that's reality because it's all we've ever known. It's just like the Matrix in some ways, right? That's what we think is reality. And because we think it's reality, we all have engaged in an endless game where I say, hey, I can predict what's coming next better than you can. And we pride ourselves, and we give prizes, right, and awards to the people that can predict better what will come. But what we don't know is that they are shadows of shadows, imitations of imitations, twice removed from reality. And then one day, one of the prisoners breaks his chains, or perhaps somebody breaks his chains. It's kind of almost a synergy there, right? And he breaks his chains, and he turns around, and immediately he's blinded by the fire, right? And he gets disoriented. And it takes him a while. And eventually he leaves the chair and he's able to look at the fire. And then he sees the puppets and he begins to realize what he thought was reality is just the shadows of these puppets. And he is astounded. All of his world has been turned upside down. What does this mean? And after a while, when his eyes really get accustomed to the fire, he begins to make his way out of the cave. And as he comes out of the cave into the real world, he, of course, is blinded by the sun, which is the ultimate example of the fire. The fire is just a lesser sun, if you will. And at first, all he can do is look at reflections of things in the water. And slowly, he's able to lift his eyes until he can look to the sun and see the nature of reality. Now, he'd like to stay out there because now he knows what is truly true and really real, as I think Schaefer would say that. But he knows he has a duty. He needs to go back into the cave and liberate the people, tell them what the world is really like. And let's say he made his way back into the cave. Now he would be actually stumbling because there would be less light than he's used to out in the world. And guess what? He would no longer be able to predict what's coming next. So everybody would think, man, wherever you went, you came back stupider, buddy. You're an absent-minded professor. You can't even play this game. And he would try to say, no, this is not real. Reality's outside. Come with me. And if he insisted, what would they do? They would beat him and they would kill him. Now, Plato clearly has in mind his master, Socrates, who he saw die. But really, is this not a glimpse of Christ, the ultimate God who actually comes into our world, into our playhouse of signifiers, as the postmoderns would say, and comes in and tries to reveal the truth and is put to death? It's amazing. It reads like a pagan prophecy. And it's kind of interesting because this really comes in the context of something he says earlier in the Republic. He wants to figure out what is justice in and of itself. And so we make up these two hypothetical people. One person is a completely unjust man, but he convinces everybody he is just and becomes a great leader and dictator. Another one is a perfectly just man, but everybody thinks he's unjust, and because of that, they put him to death. Another reference to Socrates, but a strange pagan foreshadowing of Christ. Okay, now, what does this cave allegory mean? The inside the cave is our world of being. And in fact, the fire represents our sun. It's kind of, we have to flip it around in our mind. Outside the cave is the world of being, the real world.
Just in case our listeners are tracking, the first time you said that inside the cave is the world of being, that's the world of the coming.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I got that wrong. Let me go back.
I just want to make sure. I know they're going to be listening closely.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you for saying that. Continue. So inside the cave is the world of becoming. Thank you. That's our world, world of change where nothing is permanent. Thank you. Outside the cave, what we think of as our world, in the allegory, it's the world of being, it's the heavens. And all of the things that you see in the real world are the forms in the world of being. And so the sun, okay, our sun is actually represented by the fire in the cave. But the sun in the allegory is the form of the forms, which Plato usually referenced as the good. The form of the forms out of which everything comes. It's almost like a movement towards kind of God, towards the ultimate that is behind everything. And again, what it means to be a philosopher is to make your way out of the cave to perceive that which is true, good, and beautiful. And that's the journey that the philosopher goes on. Now, Socrates is most famous or infamous for saying, we will never have a just republic until philosophers are kings and kings are philosophers. But we have to force them to do it because they don't want to rule. Just like the guy doesn't want to go back into the cave, the true philosopher doesn't want to be philosopher king. He wants to be in a cottage somewhere, you know, meditating on goodness, truth, and beauty. But he needs to be brought back. Now, why is the philosopher the best ruler? Because to be the best ruler, you need to know to be the best judge. But you can't be the best judge unless you understand and perceive justice with a capital J. So you're the one that knows the blueprint of what everything should look like. Now, a lot of people think, the Republic is just a silly bit of idealistic fluff. Nobody ever took it seriously. I would argue, and I haven't made this up, there's other people that would agree, I would argue that throughout the Middle Ages, Plato's Republic was lived out because even though, yes, there was a Holy Roman Emperor and there were princes and stuff, the real center of society for almost 1,000 years in the Middle Ages, the people that we looked up to were not the richest people, like in our world of being, okay, but the people that had the most understanding of goodness, truth, and beauty, the people that devoted their life to meditation. Who were they? They were the priests, the nuns, the monks, the bishops. Okay, it's interesting that in the Middle Ages, those who pray were often seen as the heart and soul of society, and people looked to them for wisdom. They didn't go to some psychotherapist, okay? They went to, a true psychologist, a doctor of the soul, to people that understood what is truly true and really real. So in some ways, yes, it's worked its way out. And, now we've kind of lost this in America, but interesting, if you go to a place like China or India, they have an intense respect for teachers. And I mean teachers of all ages and all, you know, ranks of school. They look to the teacher as one who devotes himself to wisdom and wants to lead others into wisdom. That's why, like in China, when a teacher walks in the room, everybody stands up. Can you imagine them doing that now? That would be like a joke. We stand up for a judge. Maybe we understand justice, right? But this idea that Plato has given to us, and Plato said the ultimate journey is to move upward to catch a glimpse of what he called the beatific vision. Now, even though the word beatific sounds like the word beautiful, it's actually the word, the Latin word for blessed. So the blessed vision is the vision of ultimate truth and goodness. Guess what? Through the Middle Ages, especially someone like Thomas Aquinas, the ultimate goal is to ascend to God and have the beatific vision. But the difference, the beautiful, wonderful difference, is Plato's beatific vision is of finally impersonal forms, whereas the Christian beatific vision is of the transpersonal triune God in whom we want to be and move towards. So there's a good example of taking Plato and extending him into the fuller revelation of Christ in the New Testament.
That was incredible. Well, for this last part, connecting it to C.S. Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
The beautiful part is throughout all of that, I think everyone got a very clear image of how it connects really well to Christianity, which is fantastic. Yeah, can you just kind of bring a little bit to either The Great Divorce, The Last Battle? These are some ones that you bring into. I think listeners, the funny part is listeners are probably hearing this and they're already connecting it completely in their head. So much of what you described sounds like the Great Divorce.
We already mentioned the Last Battle. So, yes, my single favorite Lewis book is The Great Divorce. It's incredible.
Yes!
And in it, again,
David and mine too.
It's your favorite. It's just amazing. It's worth reading all the time. It's also one of the best works of psychology I've ever read because it unpacks what I like to call the psychology of sin. Because sin doesn't just cut us off from God. I think it literally dehumanizes us, robs us of our humanity. And that's what he also shows that in Screwtape Letters, but he shows it particularly in The Great Divorce. Imagine if the people in hell were allowed, if they wanted, to get on a bus and go in the bus to heaven or to the outer part of heaven. And let's say when they get there to the plane outside of heaven, they are met by the souls of the saints, the blessed souls. And those souls try to convince them, even now, to give up their sin and disobedience and rebellion and embrace the love and grace and mercy of Christ. What would they do? And Lewis shows us that with one exception, every one of them chooses to go back to hell. It's amazing. We can have a whole discussion on that. But what I want to focus on here is Lewis's depiction of heaven as opposed to hell or earth is very Platonic. Because in The Great Divorce, heaven is more real than the earth. He talks about this also in a chapter in The Problem of Pain called Heaven. You want to definitely read that. You want to read another essay or actually sermon he wrote called The Weight of Glory. End of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader and the beginning of Silver Chair. There's lots of books that give us glimpses of heaven, of Aslan's country, it's called in Narnia. But all of them are similar in the sense that, once again, heaven is more real, not less real than the earth. And Lewis gives us a wonderful metaphor that Plato would have loved. Okay, compared to the reality of heaven, the ghosts from hell are so insubstantial, so unreal, that they cannot even bend the grass of heaven. When they try to walk on the grass, it's like needles on their feet, and they can't bend it. That's how much more real and substantial heaven is. And what is happening in The Great Divorce is not only inviting people to open their heart to Christ, it's inviting them to come into the greater reality that Christ offers, that Christ is, in fact, right? Because God doesn't just exist. God is real. In a book called Miracles, Lewis calls it the ultimate fact. And he actually says something like that in The Great Divorce as well. And he says it to this Episcopal ghost who's like, oh, no, man, that's too concrete for God. Please, you're offending me. Wonderful, the Episcopal ghost. Gosh, there's so much we could talk about. But the point is that the journey to Christ is a journey into greater light, as it is in Dante, a journey into greater light and greater reality. And we have it all topsy-turvy. We think that heaven is just gas, okay? And we're real. No, look, there's one point where this person in hell wants to steal an apple from heaven and bring it down to hell so he can have a commodity to sell, so he can get the economy of hell. It's really kind of funny. And you know what? He can't even lift that little apple. It kills him. And even if he did, he's told that apple would not fit into hell. Hell is so shriveled up, so insubstantial, that if we little bird were to swallow all of hell, it wouldn't even feel it in its gut, right? So that's the problem with our sin, is it's so nothingness, right? Look, one of the things that Lewis learned from Augustine, and even though Plato didn't say this per se, he influenced Augustine, is the idea that evil is a negation, a privation, a lie. There is no evil opposite to good. There is good, and evil is a perversion of that good. Evil cannot create anything. Evil can only take that which good has created and pervert it, or get us to... Satan cannot even create a pleasure. All he can do is take the pleasures God created and get us to use those pleasures in the wrong way at the wrong time with the wrong person, okay? So again, this is something that's in Plato. It's perfected in Augustine and others and Dante and whatnot. And Lewis is an heir of all this wonderfulness of how – and what's wonderful too is in, going back to the last battle – heaven, yeah. Aslan's country, there is a Narnia there, but it's the real Narnia. It's the Narnia they all love, and they caught glimpses of it in their Narnia, in their cave Narnia, but only now in the heavenly Narnia do they see the reality, the origin of everything they've ever yearned for. And I'll end just quickly with this. One of the best Platonic places in Lewis, and it's almost a reworking of the cave, is in the silver chair. And in the silver chair, there's this evil witch. You know about it? The green witch who has built an underland prison for Rillian. And she captures the children, the heroes, and she tries to convince them that all there is her world, that her underland is the real world, and all their talk of Narnia and the sun and Aslan are just games, just shadows, right? And she tries to convince them what Freud and other people and Nietzsche tried to convince us is that all there is are the torches that light my world. But you wondered what the torch would be like if it got bigger and bigger and hung from the sky, and so you invented this sun. Just like Moses said in Moses and monotheism, Freud said that we call him the Heavenly Father because Moses or other people took, he probably didn't believe there was a real Moses, took their earthly father and projected him upward to invent a Heavenly Father. No. The Heavenly Father is the primary one, and earthly fatherhood is a reflection or imitation of that divine father. So read that passage in the silver chair and see how the children work their way out of the cave that the witch has tried to convince them of. But, so I'm going to end here, Lewis actually outdoes Plato, because whereas in Plato's allegory of the cave, the people have only known the cave and nothing else, in his story, his children actually know there's a real sun, that there's a real Aslan, that Narnia is real. But in a matter of 5 minutes, the witch has convinced them that everything they know is real is unreal. And you know what I would compare that to? I would compare that to these wonderful homeschooling parents that I speak for, these classical Christian education, these parents that spend all this money and time to raise their children in a classical Christian environment so they know that which is true and good and beautiful. They do all of this. They sacrifice all of it. And then for a little bit of vanity, they send their son to Harvard or Yale or Princeton so that they can destroy everything they taught them in one semester. So beware, okay? Just give up these stupid secular universities and build our own universities, yeah, like mine, Houston Christian, and other ones, and just give up. Why do you want to send your kid to be brainwashed and to learn nothing of any real value. These used to be great schools, but not anymore. Okay. In fact, the irony is that if you really want to learn the pagan classics, you have to go to a Christian school because the secular schools have thrown them out as well. It's unbelievable what we've come to, right? So anyway, so what I'm saying is our world, our social media can now, TikTok can now take children who know the truth and try to convince them that it's all an illusion and all that's real is power, basically. So we need Plato to open our eyes. Now, luckily, we've got Lewis to teach us that, okay? And let me end by saying this. Look, I think Plato is often easier to understand than some of the academic works about Plato, okay? Yeah, read my book and then go read it. Read The Republic. Read The Symposium. Read The Phaedrus. Read The Timaeus. Dive in and read those books. I would begin, though, with The Apology of Socrates because that's wonderful. And then from there, read these dialogues and don't knock yourself on the head and think I can't understand this, because if you really concentrate, I think you will. Okay. So that's my challenge to you. Get out there and read your Plato, because as the professor says, it's all in Plato. What did they teach the children?
That was an incredible way to wrap it up. And I was going to ask you, if someone had never read Plato, how you'd recommend they begin, but you just did. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that? Or is that, was that you kind of just shared a good little progression?
I mean, I think that's the way to go. I have an annotated bibliography in my book and stuff like that. Well, I guess I should say, if you want to know anything about me, the easiest way is to go to Amazon, type in my name, Lewis Marcos with a K, M-A-R-K-O-S, Greek name. And you'll see all my books there and stuff like that. And I've got a lot, because my passion, again, is to try to build bridges between our Greco-Roman legacy and our Judeo-Christian legacy. And of course, Lewis was one of the people that did that. And I just try to carry on the work, if you will.
Well, you're doing an absolutely fantastic job. And listeners, I would definitely recommend going checking out those other books, because this book was incredible. The conversations that I've heard Dr. Marcos have on this show have just been incredible. So definitely go check that out. As a reminder, it's From Plato to Christ, How Platonic Thought Shaped the Christian Faith. And I hear the call for final drinks. So thank you to our sound engineers, Taylor and Sarah. Thank you to all of our listeners and Patreon supporters, particularly our top tier ones. And we pray for our listeners and all the prayer requests in our Slack channel every Tuesday. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share this on social media. This is a perfect one, guys, to share. I always love to highlight that, because you know, sometimes the interseason ones are building on a set book, so you can't really just send a singular episode because if they miss the first ones. But this is just a fantastic one-off episode to get a taste of Plato plus Lewis. Send it to them. And if you listen to one podcast, this one, please join us next time when we'll continue going further up and further in. Cheers.
Cheers.